I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next. A dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
And good morning. Welcome to What's Next. Glad to be along with you today live on WBFO. And with us, Andre Stokes. Andre is the Senior Director of Specialty Substance Use Disorder Services at Best Self Behavioral Health. Also a variety of other experiences that we have explored to a certain extent in previous programs, but looking forward to expanding on those conversations today. Andre, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, and good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Always great to have you along, and there's so much to get into here, but we'll just start off with the idea that it is Men's Mental Health Awareness Month is June. What about that? I mean, these months, and nice to have them, I guess, nice to help promote certain ideas at the same time. What about men's mental health awareness? Are enough men aware of mental health and the possibilities and the possible pitfalls out there?
I would say a lot more men are becoming more aware.
Okay.
Since we have a much larger movement on mental health awareness, and that's something that I definitely love to see. There are still a number of folks who are less aware of Men's Mental Health Awareness Month, and I think that's where the community does a lot, or can do, continue to do a lot to bring more awareness, to kind of reach those hard to gather individuals for the awareness month.
How about for you as a professional counselor, those conversations, maybe people just find out, oh, you're in mental health, so that do you get that, oh, that's for other people kind of a thing sometimes? Or is there more, do you see that interest lighting up? Like, oh, maybe you have some answers for me.
I definitely see the interest. When okay. It's brought up, I see the interest. And that's another beautiful thing to see, because I know during previous decades, it would be more of a, that's not for me, and that's for other people. But now, since we have a new awareness about it, it's definitely piqued the interest of a lot of people who may have not been able to have that interest if this was 1980s, 1990s. So it's good to be in a present time where we are more open about that and can do a little bit more to support the needs of the folks who have them.
Yeah, I'd certainly agree that the awareness of mental health issues, mental health self-care are much, certainly we hear more about it today than we did, like you said, 10, 20, 30 years ago, for sure. What has changed, would you say? What is driving that awareness?
I think what drives that awareness is, it can be broken down into a few things. I think the first and foremost, there's the increase of the opioid epidemic and the addiction aspects that kind of plague most or all communities, rather. And where there's addiction, there's a mental health component as well, because
right.
those
we don't always
things,
make that connection, maybe, right?
Yes, they're very, very connected, just like a DNA sequence.
Sure.
So since we are kind of working through an addiction epidemic, that helps bring forth the awareness for mental health, and having one thing bounce off another can be very, very beneficial for the types of interventions and reactions that a lot of agencies and a lot of the culture has on that.
Okay. And let's just explore that connection. And like you said, that's unfortunately, it's taken something like the opioid epidemic to help drive awareness of mental health.
Yes.
Let's maybe push it maybe before the before the addiction occurs. I guess our personalities, to a certain extent, this where I'll show my ignorance on the level of mental health, but there's certain types of personalities or certain characteristics that might lend themselves to addictive behavior, for lack of a better term. What about, I mean, just in terms of mental health care, and you know, whether you're a parent who's watching their child come into these ages where, of course, there's so many pitfalls out there, advice for them, or even just for any of us out there, things that we should know about ourselves, things that we should be checking to make sure that we're, you know, we can stay above, you know, the unfortunate things that happen to those who become addicted. And we see it happens to everybody.
Yeah. Some of the things that I would say we can check within ourselves are our social settings,
okay,
first and foremost. So I always say, be mindful of your diet. And by diet, I'm not talking about what you eat and what you, you know, what you consume in your stomach. I'm talking about your intellectual diet, your social diet.
Okay.
What are the things that you are consuming socially within your area, within your surroundings, the things you hear, the things you're watching and listening to on social media and television and so forth? I think those have a significant impact on some of our decision making. You know, so for example, sometimes we listen to, you know, society has a kind of a relationship with media.
No doubt.
And media can sometimes perpetuate behaviors and lifestyles that are counterproductive to real life people.
Mm.
And it can be difficult for some folks to kind of see the line between their actual life and what they're consuming in their diet on TV and in social media. And we all have phones in our pockets too, so we have that easy access to some of the things that may not be within our best interest as far as lifestyle.
Best interest. Okay, that's a great term to use right there. What's in our best interest? And I guess let's explore that just a little bit. Best interest. Everything's individualized, of course, and I'm sure it goes case to case. But still, there probably are some things that you're seeing that stand out.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. I think some of the things that I see that stand out are also our, the way we perceive certain things that happen to us. So when we're dealing with certain types of trauma, we have options to react to that trauma. We could, you know, kind of keep ourselves at a certain level by not addressing, or we can address those traumas by doing whatever we need to do on a therapeutic level. And by therapeutic, I don't necessarily mean always clinical,
okay,
but just for ourselves. What can you do alone, or what can you do without the intervention of someone else? You know, so
what,
you know,
okay, counselor, up. What can I do? Well, of course, well, I've got you for the next hour, so I've got you. I've got lots of things to talk about. Sorry.
That's okay. That's all right.
But yeah, that's fine. But yeah, so what are some of those things that perhaps, like you said, going to a counselor, going to a professional, always a great option. We're hearing that more. We're seeing that more. That's great. But what about what we can do for ourselves?
Mm-hmm. I would say time management. So time management definitely plays a role in mental health and some of our triggers.
Really?
Yes. So when we're thinking about time management, we have to consider the things that we have to do in our daily adventures, our daily duties. So making sure that we are time sensitive and kind of keeping on track with, I want to say due dates, but due times, mm-hmm, can help us with the stress levels. And of course, as we know, the stress levels, if not addressed, lead to further mental health challenges such as anxiety, depression, or the exacerbation of other mental health diagnoses as well. So that's one of the newer things that I'm starting to explore, how time management and the essence of time itself can impact the way we feel and the way we think, which then impacts our decision-making process.
That's an interesting connection. Unfortunately, when you say time management, for me, it conjures up a stress about work. But I did. I like the way you said the essence of time.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
What are you seeing about that? Because it sounds like something. This is also kind of maybe a new page for you to a certain extent of trying to understand that and relate that to people who are dealing with mental health issues.
Right. Right. So when folks are dealing with mental health issues, the essence of time is essential in the sense that when we're working through things, we want to make sure that we address them sooner rather than later.
Hmm.
If we're waiting and kind of prolonging and procrastinating on addressing those things, then that's more time. That's a bigger chunk of time. Where there's bigger chunks of time, that allows for opportunity for things to get inside those bigger chunks of time that may be maladaptive, different maladaptive behaviors such as negative coping mechanisms, drug use and things like that and so forth. So when we are able to shorten the amount of time between the problem and not the solution, but the start to considering a solution, then that's a way to kind of manage mental health symptoms overall.
Are you seeing that a lot in the people that you're talking with or that you're helping, that time, that essence of time issue is a big part of things?
Right, absolutely. And it's a fine line. So when working with the community, I think it's important to also be careful to discuss time, but not in a way where they're being pushed or rushed into
not giving them deadlines necessarily.
Right. Okay. Just explaining how time is important within the essence of recovery and kind of tying it into, let's say, physical health. If you have a chronic illness, of course, you will want your doctor to intervene with, you know, whatever treatments or medications or interventions that are needed sooner rather than 6, 8, 9 months from now. Because within a 6, 8 month period, a year long period, other things can happen.
Right.
Other physical ailments can begin or they can increase if you already have them. So just making sure that folks are aware of the importance of time rather than rushing them and saying, you got to go to treatment. You have to do this. You have to do this. You have to do it now. Not everybody can move now. Some people need time to process. We all need time to process, right, as a matter of fact. So just keeping it on the board so that people can see how time impacts the way we feel from the mental health perspective, I think is very, very important.
Is that, I would think it might be a surprise. If I was coming to you when you were helping me and you would turn to me and say, you know, how are you managing your time? Or how come we've been talking about this for the last 3 months and you haven't done X? I mean, I guess how quickly can people really relate to the idea that what you're trying to say right here, that you're only exacerbating this problem by delaying it?
Yeah, sometimes some people can catch on really quickly. Mm-hmm. And I think that depends on the delivery and the relationship someone has with their counselor.
All right.
So if it's a new counselor or someone, not a new counselor, but someone that's new to them, I would imagine it has a far less chance of sticking. Because when you build that rapport with someone, they're more likely to kind of listen to what you're saying and receive it in a different way, in the way that it's intended. And a lot of that can come from not just the relationship that they have with their therapist, their counselor, or their provider, but also their connection with them from a background perspective as well.
As you're talking here, I'm seeing you kind of work through how you are dealing with different individuals, and I'm wondering for you, do you have to have a lot of different approaches to how you're going to address these issues? It seems to me like you have to read the room a little bit and read the individual. Yes. How do you go about making those determinations? Or is it just trial and error?
Sometimes it is trial and error, but sometimes, most of the time for me at least, it's reading the room. Mm-hmm. So being able to take that time to feel someone out, feel their energy, connect with them and see how they react to certain things you say, you begin to learn to pick up on those things. So as you kind of make the assessment, the personal assessment, not the actual assessment on paper for why they are there, but that personal assessment, you get a feel of where you can go with that person within, let's say, 15 minutes.
Okay.
And using that to your advantage, I think, is very, very important when figuring out the best ways to provide a service to someone. So you can provide the same type of service ending, but in most cases you'll have to do it differently for each person depending on how they perceive what you're saying.
I'm intrigued about this in the sense, and I also want to put the disclaimer out there, and anytime I think I'm walking over that bridge into confidentiality, I want to make sure that you know that that's the case, that I want to make sure I'm respectful of that.
Thank you.
But what can you give me maybe an example or a general idea of, okay, I see this when I saw this reaction, and then I had to change course. Mm-hmm. Can you think of an example like that that you could share?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So a few years ago, I worked with an individual who came in for counseling, for treatment. And during my assessment process, I assessed that this person would be good for an inpatient stay at another place. So I gently mentioned an inpatient stay, but not from the perspective of this person going to inpatient.
Okay.
I mentioned an inpatient treatment facility and what they have, just to see how this person will react.
Okay.
And I was looking to see if they would say, "Oh, yeah, no, inpatient. That's for someone else. I don't need that." Or if the response would be on the opposite end of the spectrum and say, "Oh, really? Well, I can understand how inpatient treatment would work for a person who's struggling with some of the things that I struggle with."
Yeah.
So kind of gauging, you know, kind of fishing. Right. Let's call it fishing.
All right. So you have that idea in mind, and then you see. So what are you looking for? Physical reaction, just a verbal reaction? What do you got?
Both.
Yeah.
I like to look at body language.
Yeah.
So when someone is more lean back like this, they're comfortable.
Okay.
I don't want to say comfortable. That might be a reach, but they're less uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But when someone starts to fidget when you mention certain things, it's like, okay, that's an area that they may not be comfortable with. So when you see the fidgeting start, kind of pivot a little bit and go left and go down a different street to get them to fidget less and get them to lean back a little bit more.
Okay.
When you're able to get people to lean back, they're listening more. They're listening more with intent, and they're going to be less likely to battle what you're saying.
Just curious, did you see me fidgeting when you were talking about time management?
Yes.
Wow, you're really good. Andre Stokes is with us. Andre is the Senior Director of Specialty Substance Use Disorder Services at Best Self Behavioral Health. And also we're here talking about Men's Mental Health Awareness Month, which is June. All right, how about time of the year? Time of the year. We're heading into summer. Life can get going real fast. We want to be laid back, like you were saying right there, but we also know that there's only so much time in the summer. What are some of the things that maybe, you know, I'm sure there's a variety of things that happen year-round in terms of mental health issues, but what maybe might we see at this time of the year?
I think in the summertime, when it gets warmer, the data shows that overdoses tend to increase.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. More people are spending more time outside because the weather is very appropriate. And when folks are able to go outside, they're able to meet a little bit more and to spend more time with the people that they associate with.
Mm.
In turn, that has a connection to increased substance use versus the colder months. There's more gatherings, there are more parties, there's you know, just more outside time in general. And when people are able to get together, things can happen. Versus wintertime, November, December, people can't really go outside like they want to. So having that, the increase in social activity increases substance use as well.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So, okay, that's a thing right now.
Yes.
Any words of advice? You know, we can speak to the individual who might find themselves in it, but words of advice for friends, family members, you know, parents, about that. I mean, or maybe just the idea, like you said, mm-hmm. This is the time of the year to be on the alert for it.
Right. I would say also be sure to enjoy your time. Enjoy the summer. You know, we only get 10 minutes of summer a year in Buffalo.
Yes.
So enjoy that time while we have it, but also be mindful and keep an eye out on your family members, your loved ones, anybody that you think might be struggling, because the warmer months is where things are more likely to happen. So enjoy your time, but enjoy your time in a way that is a bit more wise and a bit more aware of the surroundings and the things that are happening in each community.
You're talking about your conversations with the people you're trying to assist, that you're short on demands. You're not looking to, don't do this, you don't give a lot of that. At the same time, when somebody may have already be dealing with a substance abuse issue, like you said, it's summertime. You're going to bump into your friends again.
Mm-hmm.
You know what could happen there. we know all about best intentions. Talk about that dynamic about what people should be watching for and what happens to them. I'm resolved. I'm not going to go down that road again. I've done that before. Yet you're getting together the same party that you've gone to the last three summers, and we know what happened there. How do you address those?
I like to, when I see those and I address those, I like to talk about how individuals are not only more likely to party, but they're more likely to get into things that might be harder.
Hmm.
The springtime and the summertime are times for the introduction of new substances. So
really?
Kind of that quote unquote graduation phase.
Hmm.
And, you know, when folks are new to substances, then they may develop newer problems or more intense problems. So in addition, when folks are in treatment and trying to walk that path, I think it's important to be mindful of coping mechanisms and new skills that they may have learned with their provider, with their counselor, such as being able to kind of redirect conversations when they approach, when they're at hand, and being able to say no, but in a way that's comfortable for them. So a lot of times when we think about the word no, that's hard for some people.
Yeah.
That can be very challenging for some people, especially folks in addiction. When the word no not only means I'm not going to socialize, but it also may mean that I'm not going to get this particular thing that I like to use.
Right.
So getting people comfortable with the idea of rejecting opportunities, but in a graceful manner that they're most comfortable with, is very important to maintaining the path that they're trying to walk. And that can be very difficult when a lot of things are present in the summer, because we're outside and we're able to do things, we're able to go places. So learning the no, but not necessarily just a no, because that can be challenging, but learning how to word it in a way that is graceful and more redirective versus a refusal. So for example, hey, do you want to go here? We have this new thing that we want to try.
Mm.
It could be option A could be no. Or option B could be, well, I'd really rather get to my appointment because I've been working with XYZ for 3 months. I'd really rather do that. Or I have, you know, to go pick up my kids from this place at that time, so I won't be able to do it, and things like that. So it's helpful to allow people to learn how to say no, but in an indirect way, and to add a prior engagement into that response.
Graduation into other substances. Boy, that's a daunting way of
yes.
looking at graduation, isn't it? But
yes.
But it's something that's true. What are we seeing? What are you seeing in terms of what people are dealing with right now? I mean, you know, fentanyl, of course, has been the big substance that we've been hearing a lot about in the last year or two. Mm-hmm. What about right now?
Yes, fentanyl is it's everywhere. It's in, especially with our youth. We have to be a lot more careful with our youth because they're, of course, not fully developed, and they're more impressionable. And being impressionable increases the chances of a youth trying some new things. And you mentioned fentanyl. Fentanyl is in everything. There's more fentanyl in cocaine now than there is in heroin. So folks are, you know, experimenting with new things, and fentanyl is in, it's in marijuana, it's everywhere. And we have to be mindful of the way we teach substance use to children as well, because it could be, you think you're trying something, but then that could also be an overdose, and worst case scenario, the loss of another person. So keeping that in mind is, I think, very, very important for everyone, but especially our youth, because it's the summertime. Kids are outside, they want to play basketball, they want to do sports, they want to swim. All the kids have friends, some of the friends do things, and it can be a transition period.
And just to clarify, though it's slightly outside your realm, no matter, especially when it comes to youth, access to these substances is universal right now?
Yes.
It doesn't matter, city, suburbs, rural.
does not matter. The substances, the addiction itself, the access to the substances does not discriminate. It's everywhere, every town, every corner. Some towns may do a little bit better at hiding it, but it's everywhere, and the access is it's there.
Hmm. We got a lot to talk about here. It's yes. June is Men's Mental Health Awareness Month. Our guest is Andre Stokes. We're going to take a short time out. We'll come back with more. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Hey, educators. You've been asking for it, and it's here. Reading Rainbow Stories is ready to help your students stay on track. Each story is paired with activities to help students strengthen cross-curricular skills, such as math and business in Lemonade for Sale.
Let's keep track of our sales.
Science and health in Germs Make Me Sick.
Usually, you feel better after a day or two.
Thanks.
But if you don't, you should see a doctor.
And history in Following the Drinking Gourd.
One of the worst things about slavery is that families were separated. Fathers, mothers, and children were oftentimes sold to different people.
Check out the new Reading Rainbow Stories collection on PBS Learning Media today to help your students stay on track.
Join WBFO every Saturday at 6 p.m. for an insightful and enlightening series of audio documentaries from our region that tackle topics such as the environment, health, the world of entertainment, and more. Listen to the WBFO DocuHour every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on WBFO, your NPR station.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
And welcome back to What's Next. Our guest this morning is Andre Stokes. Andre is the Senior Director of Specialty Substance Use Disorder Services at Best Self Behavioral Health. June is Men's Mental Health Awareness Month, but we want to do just a little bit of a transition here because Andre recently gave a presentation at the Institute of for Disaster Mental Health Conference. The title, Responder Resiliency and Buffalo's 514.
Yes.
That's some heavy, heavy sounding stuff right there.
Very.
Maybe just give us an overview of what you're, maybe even let's talk about the conference, because I think it's interesting that we even have, a disaster mental health conference. Let's talk about the purpose there and what you experienced.
Yeah, so the purpose of the conference was to bring providers and anyone else in the community together to talk about the different types of disaster mental health. So disaster mental health meaning can come from community violence, can come from accidents, can come from weather related incidents, hurricanes, tsunamis, and storms like that. And putting people together to talk about how people have experienced from the professional perspective, how they've experienced certain incidences, and creating a network of professional support and education to one another to kind of bounce ideas off and to learn things so that we can respond to things in a more efficient manner and respond to them differently if need be. So it was a very, very wonderful conference with tons of providers, military vets, police officers, EMTs, 911 operators, counselors, clinicians, and pretty much everything. Anybody that responds to a crisis or anyone who's involved in responding to a crisis. It was a wonderful conference, and I was able to learn so much from a lot of different people who had attended the conference and folks who had presented as well.
All right, so you tell me, you said you learned. So that's an interesting way. And it's interesting the tie-in here, because when you use the term disaster, I think the initial image is, like you said, like a weather-related mm-hmm. scenario, wildfires, tornadoes, hurricanes, things along those lines. Of course, you talked about 514, and I'm sure others brought in their own different experiences when we kind of expand the understanding of that term disaster. So what about for you? What were some of the takeaways for you?
Some of the takeaways for me were I kind of tuned in a lot to the police officer perspective of different events that had happened within the United States in the last 10 to 15 years.
Okay.
And getting the perspective of the police officers and the military folks helped me understand how responding to different disasters, to the same disaster from different perspectives, such as, you know, police and religious clergy and clinicians and all those sorts of things, many, many different approaches and different disciplines to tend to the same disaster. And it helped me gather a perspective of we're all working together, but differently within our respective disciplines to provide the same outcome to the people affected by that disaster, which is getting people to a point where they're okay and they can continue. So when we're talking about physical violence and you know, weather related things and shootings, it's all linear in a way. So let's say we have a shooting, and typically the first people there are police and EMS services. So they're providing that service first. Once the area and once the situation is stabilized, then social workers, counselors, doctors, and those sorts of disciplines are next to come in. So it's interesting to see the order and the structure of who provides a service first, second, third, fourth, and so forth, and what they're doing within their respective discipline to kind of not counter but bounce off of the previous structure, the previous order, and how those things tie into one another like a DNA sequence. You know, they're so different, but we all have the same goal with our different skill sets. So it's really nice to see all these different sectors come together for the benefit of people. And it's people working for people with different tools, whether they're physical tools or their intellectual tools and things that they've learned throughout their times in their respective fields. It's a wonderful thing to see. And I was able to take in a lot of the police perspective while I was there.
So the police perspective, let's look at that then maybe from two sides of the coin. Mm-hmm. One being how they, you know, police, they're coming into a situation, and it could be a thousand different situations, but you know, it's if they're being called in an emergency, you know, we understand the intensity right there.
Yeah.
So they can only deal with the individuals they deal with. I mean, they have a certain protocol, right,
yeah,
in terms of securing and making things safe. So they can't necessarily be worried about somebody else's mental health when mm-hmm. they're responding. But what about their mental health, what they take from these moments, and how that might linger with them.
Yeah, that is a fantastic point. And I within my presentation, I had spoken a lot about that. And the first responders from the security perspective, that's being military and police and 911 operators, they take in a lot. And one of the barriers that sector has is the silence. So when folks are dealing with, let's say, physical trauma, police officers, military vets, and so forth, the culture, from my own research and from the things that I've gathered from the other presenters, the culture within the police organizations and the military organizations can be challenging because seeking help is not as widely used within that sector.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the way the culture is. So there was a gentleman there named Travis Gribble, a fantastic presenter, and he spoke a lot about how some police departments shy away from the aspect of mental health because they may feel as though people won't understand because they're not police officers. So part of the culture that he mentioned was keeping it within the department itself, and kind of bouncing ideas off of one another through ways that are healthy and ways that can be unhealthy, such as alcohol use and so forth. So I predict in time that the culture of that can change because it's already in the process of changing. There are a lot of police departments that are more inclusive and incorporating mental health care services to officers and to operators and to EMS providers and so forth. And that's a beautiful thing to see. And Buffalo has done very well at putting those things together. There's peer services and so forth within the police departments themselves, full time. And being able to kind of be alive during that time of transition is a blessing to me, because of course we need our officers. We need everybody who works in the force, and making sure that they're taken care of is should be a huge priority, and it's becoming more of a priority, and that creates for more opportunities for more folks to see that, hey, police officers are now doing mental health within the department. Maybe firefighters will be next. Maybe firefighters, and then maybe EMS workers, and then maybe 911 operators. So incorporating more of that mental health piece into those sectors will be beneficial for not only the sectors themselves, but for the communities that they're serving.
I was going to ask about that. So you believe that by improving the mental health and of police, we'll use the police just to limit it here, that is going to make for a better police force.
Definitely. In a sense of, not even from the community perspective, but from the sense of the culture of the force itself. So it was explained to us by police officers that they suffer in silence. They suffer in silence. And a lot of times that silence turns into individuals removing themselves, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And there has been an increase in police officers removing themselves from the situations over the last 10 years or so due to the stress levels and not feeling comfortable enough to seek the professional support outside of the police force. And we're looking as a whole to make those small changes and grow those changes over time.
I'm curious, and I'm not sure if this came up, but when you were hearing from the police perspective, was there also a concern in the sense that police are under even more scrutiny today than they were previously, with body cameras, social media, and perhaps the sense that the community doesn't understand what I have to do?
Mm-hmm.
Were you hearing that kind of thing?
Yes, I did. There is the scrutiny, and that's one of the big things that they deal with, because when folks are, you know, joining the field of law enforcement, they're joining the field of law enforcement for a positive reason. They want to serve and protect. I know plenty of police officers personally who have joined the police force to serve and protect, and that is the idea of joining. And part of the stress that they experience, per what I've been told, is coming in with good intentions and coming in good faith, and then having a label put on them that is unbecoming, right? And of course, we know the media doesn't let us forget certain things. And like I mentioned earlier, we're so attached to our phones, we're so attached to Twitter and Facebook and the news and everything. And a lot of times, those things can keep us in a certain headspace, you know, and officers have to deal with that, and that creates more stress that they deal with or they don't deal with. So part of the presentation from Mr. Travis Gribble spoke about doing well, but sometimes being perceived as not doing well, which can be very stressful for anyone, but especially for police officers.
Perceived as not doing well?
Perceived as, let me rephrase that, perceived as not being well-meaning, or
okay,
not being as well-meaning as they actually are.
Right. So their intent to serve and protect is being misconstrued from their perspective by the community, by the media, that is not the case. There may be that they're even working with opposite intentions.
Right.
I see.
Right.
And that's adding to their stress. That's adding to their, detracting from their performance.
Yeah. Then, and the overall, maybe not job performance, but satisfaction and the overall happiness, which can then lead to issues outside of the profession, you know, and we spoke about how EMS providers also have that. So being on the site of trauma and being on the site of you know, let's say Buffalo's 514 and having to, you know, be there and engage with the situation, that takes a really hard hit on their mental health. Having to see those things and having to be there and work in that setting, doing that every day and so often, even if it's a part-time job, that can have some effects. Just being so close to trauma and being the first people on scene, that has some mental health effects. And we always encourage folks who work in those fields to seek the assistance they need even before they're feeling way off. So kind of being proactive too, and just understanding the general duties of the role and seeking the assistance as you go through, so that when those things do start to happen and get worse, you're more prepared to deal with them from an intellectual standpoint.
And is there a sense that the stress or the emotion that comes with that negative viewpoint of your work as a police officer, does that maybe also change? Are we seeing it impacting the police officer's view of the community? Maybe perhaps a negative look at the very people that they're there to serve?
I hadn't heard that, but I can imagine that can be a possibility.
Okay.
I would definitely imagine that could be a possibility, because when you leave the house every day to provide a service for the community and you're not well received by all the community, I can imagine how that would create a mindset of, well, you don't really care for what I'm trying to do, so maybe XYZ.
Gotcha. Mm. Okay, thank you. All right, we're going to take one more break with Andre Stokes, and we'll come back and to finish up this hour of What's Next. Andre is Senior Director of Specialty Substance Use Disorder Services at Best Self Behavioral Health. A lot to say in this June, Men's Mental Health Awareness Month. We'll take a time out. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Did you know that WNED PBS is always working on great new local shows for you to watch? Documentaries like Kleinhand's Gift to Buffalo, which tells the story of Buffalo's Music Hall.
The hall is very intimate, and that intimacy makes everyone who comes in here feel a part of our family.
Fun and educational series like Compact Science.
Believe it or not, peppers are technically fruits.
And Shakespeare's greatest hits, featuring some of his best-known soliloquies and monologues.
We are such stuff as dreams are made of.
You can watch them all on our website at wned.org/local shows. While you're there, check out the show pages and mini websites for additional content such as bonus features, photo galleries, and lesson plans. Find it all at wned.org/local shows.
Discover the intersection of musical expression and emotional introspection. Listen to Mindful Music, hosted by mental health care worker Carl Shallowhorn. Saturdays at 4 p.m. and Sundays at 8 p.m. on WBFO.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
Welcome back to What's Next. Our guest, Andre Stokes, with us. Andre, we mentioned this in the last segment, recently spoke at the Institute for Disaster Mental Health Conference, and his presentation was Responder Resiliency and Buffalo's 514. I think we spent a real nice segment there kind of talking about, specifically about police officers and when it comes to their mental health and the stresses that they're under and how they go about dealing with it. But let's now look a little more specific. You gave this presentation, Responder Resiliency and Buffalo's 514. Give us some of the key points that you presented.
Sure thing. So the key points that I spoke about during my part of the presentation were some of the different types of stress and what factors play into not only the stress, but increasing the stress. So I spoke a little bit earlier about time, and I incorporated that into the presentation.
Okay.
Because when we were dealing with 514, there came a time specifically for me where I was I had a tunnel vision in just working and working, providing that service because it was needed. And it came to a point before I knew it where I crashed and I started to make errors on the job because I had not taken care of myself.
Mm.
So I brought that into the presentation from a personal perspective to kind of show that even though you mean well and you have the skills and you have the ability and motivation, without taking care of yourself as a responder, as a provider, then you may even not only perform well, but you may even harm the individuals that you're trying to support. So taking that authenticity and that honesty into the presentation was well received, because I think being able to be honest about the field and honest about burnout and fatigue and so forth helps the people who are listening, because again, we're in a room full of providers, and across the board, everyone in that room, everyone who was present for the conference had experienced compassion fatigue, and compassion fatigue being one of the main factors of not allowing a responder to perform at their highest level, because being in that setting and being in that circumstance for too long without stepping away or in providing or receiving some sort of help for yourself can kind of create a numbness a little bit. And that when you have that numbness, the people you're providing a service for can feel it. And we have to think about their perspective as well. So the other thing I talked about is when you have compassion fatigue, not only can you harm the people you're serving, but that may turn them off from receiving services fully because they may have had not the best experience with the service that you provided while you yourself had compassion fatigue. So keeping that in mind and how we want people to continue to receive services, and to do that, we have to take care of ourselves as well while we're taking care of them.
And I really appreciate, you know, your personal history in that sense of, like you said, quote unquote burnout, but I think it's worth taking a trip back a couple of years back to 514 and the days right after. And a lot of agencies in this area deserve a lot of credit, because I can still remember, you know, 515, you know, we have counselors at Johnny B. Wiley. We have counselors yes. waiting to help for you. There was an understanding that this was going to be needed, but you say right there that you were there, you were in it, but almost too much. Actually, you would just, I, in essence, just said that it was too much. But just take us back to the crush of outreach that people were seeking help. They needed someone to talk to. Can take us back to that a little bit?
Sure thing. So when 514 initially occurred, members of the community were very vocal about what they wanted specifically. So they knew that they wanted to talk. They knew that they wanted counselors on site, but they wanted a specific counselor. They specifically asked for people of color to come into the community to provide that service. Again, this was a racial attack. So kind of going in and allowing them to tell us how they wanted to be served and what treatment methods they wanted is what was a huge light for us. And by being trauma-informed, we were able to provide that and bring in counselors and some of our religious leaders from the community to come in and provide those immediate services. And I had a hard time with the whole, with that time, because not only did I function as a provider, I'm also a member of the community too.
Right.
And growing up within that area and still having family that live four blocks from that location, it hit me too in two different ways. So I had the compassion fatigue, but I also had the general sadness and fear of, is this going to happen again? I still have family over there. People that I know still have family in that area and so forth. So My compassion fatigue came from not only working, but from being impacted as a non-clinician as well. So finding a different way, or finding multiple ways to kind of check myself and work through those things from the professional and the personal perspective were very challenging at times, because of course I want to run in and help, but if I run in and help, I'm going to be on 25%, and what good can I be for somebody else if I'm at 25%?
And like you said, you could even be a negative factor,
right?
As well,
I can hurt someone,
right,
by not providing the service, or by providing the wrong service, or making an incorrect referral or an inappropriate referral, and so forth. So being mindful of how they needed to be served and how I needed to serve myself as well were crucial parts within, I would say, the 3 months after the initial event.
You also spent time talking with the TOPS employees.
Yes.
If as much as you can, share your experience with them.
Sure thing. So we were able to work with the TOPS employees pretty much every day, and we had a space designated for us at the Meriwether Library right across the street from TOPS, across the street and one block over. And we were able to kind of provide those individual sessions as well as group sessions on a daily basis to help them kind of cope with this unimaginable thing that had just occurred. So helping people cope with something like that is a long-term event. It's not a short-term counseling thing where you're in for 4 weeks or 5 weeks and then we're done. There are folks who are still in counseling from that, and who mentioned that they will still continue counseling for the long term as a result of that incident. So, you know, kind of creating that safe space for them to develop the rapport first, and then allow opportunities for them to express themselves to us was of the utmost importance during that time, because they had been through the absolute worst.
No doubt.
And the essence of being trauma-informed, part of it is understanding how people might perceive the treatment that they're receiving. So allowing them to kind of dictate how they want to be served was very important for us, because they were the people being served, and they were the people that had gone through that at their job, right? So just maintaining, not just creating, but maintaining that space so that they had a place to go to and kind of decompress every day was at one of the key points to that, to the operation.
Again, as much as you can share, and it was interesting to hear that you said some employees still seeking this treatment, and of course more power to them to do so as long as is necessary. Are they finding that coming to a counselor releases a kind of a stress? Are they perhaps going through forms of PTSD? What can you share?
For sure. So keeping them engaged the way we did and with counselors of color likely increased the chances of them maintaining their episodes of treatment.
Okay.
So being mindful of who's providing that service likely played a big part in them continuing, in some of them continuing the service and having that level of comfort with the provider and that level of security with the provider. And that's something that we certainly appreciate doing because it was requested. So it's, you know, if that's the request, then by all means, create it that way,
right.
Structure it that way, because someone is specifically telling you how they want to be treated. And having that in mind is very important for the long-term success of an individual who is breaking their own barrier to speak with someone.
And I don't know, how can I say generalize the experience of these TOPS employees, but you're seeing people that are doing better. I want to hear that type of encouragement.
Yes, I do see people doing better, and from time to time I do shop at that TOPS to check in, and folks are in general in outward appearance on the job doing better. And of course it's not going to be something that someone is completely healed from, because that's a very traumatic event. But seeing the incremental process and the incremental progress is one of the most important things. And I love to see folks with regain that pep in their step and regain their chipperness throughout the adversity and overcoming some of those challenges that they had experienced on 514.
Well, I'm encouraged that, and I guess I want to, you know, send my best. I mean, we yes. talked about so many elements of this, and sometimes definitely have overlooked the TOPS employees, and I wish them well, and thank you for your service to them, and
thank you.
Continue that as well. Andre, as always, another great hour sharing with us. Appreciate it today.
I appreciate it being here. This is always fantastic, and thank you very much for having me.
Andre Stokes is Senior Director of Specialty Substance Use Disorder Services at Best Self Behavioral Health. This has been What's Next on WBFO and WBFO HD1 Buffalo, WOLN Olean, and WUBJ Jamestown, your NPR station.